a physical connection to the world of rock and roll.
From Bowie to Led Zeppelin to Depeche Mode.
It doesn't matter what generation, they all want to wear those shoes.
Never mind the cobblers, the Terry de Havilland story.
Part of the Sound of Style season.
Available now at the Six Music website.
Now on Radio 4 198 Longwave and DAB Digital Radio, it's time for the Act of Worship, which today comes from Cardiff and is led by the Reverend Roy Jenkins. Here on FM, Damian Lewis reads the last instalment of Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh. The acclaimed biography of the great American playwright is by the theatre critic John Lahr. Today, Williams confronts his demons. He also addresses his troubled and long-standing relationship with Frank Merlo. A new play, Sweet Bird of Youth, reflects his inner torment.
On April Fool's Day in 1957, Williams found himself at the Starlight Lounge in Miami, nursing a third double bourbon with the hard-drinking poet Gilbert Maxwell. Williams was having a good time. He wrote in his diary,
"I announced that I was retiring from the professional theatre and going to devote myself to friendship and a good, simple life in New Orleans with analysis. Bull. How on earth do I know what I'm going to do, except that it's fairly plain that I will go on drinking and drinking and drinking and having a good time in bed whenever I can and hitting the keys on my new Olympia typewriter. A good one."
By the end of May, however, Williams, carrying through on one part of his announcement, put himself into the care of the distinguished 61-year-old psychiatrist Lawrence S. Cuby. Williams was a daunting analytic challenge. A borderline personality with tenacious, addictive, and depressive tendencies, who was rich, famous, and a genius to boot. From the outset, Cuby's treatment of Williams was special. He judged his patient too disturbed to begin analysis immediately and insisted that he first dry out and undergo medical examinations. Williams wrote from his hospital bed of his exquisite boredom.
"I don't think I can stand much of it. Can do without the liquor, and that's undoubtedly a wise move, but, well, the boredom vanished when the two docs entered and I felt suddenly trapped. Heart began doing flip-flops. I was nearly panicky."
Williams left the hospital on June 7, 1957, still uncertain whether surrendering himself to doctors and clinics would be his salvation. Torn between facing his problems and fleeing them, he chose flight, a brief excursion to Havana, Cuba. En route, he goofed and fell off the wagon. On his return, Cuby cobbled together a new analytic plan for Williams that included 5 50-minute sessions a week with him and a sort of forced separation from Frank Merlo. Williams wrote to Paul Bowles,
"My analyst is very anxious for Frank to stay in Key West till we've gotten over the hump of the analysis. We're like a couple of fighting cocks here lately, all but pecking each other's eyes out. And naturally, that is not a healthy atmosphere in which I can go on with my work with Dr. Cuby."
The process of analysis may not have been pleasant, but it did change at least one aspect of Williams's narrative, his story of his hated and hateful father. Behind the tyranny of Cece's anger, Williams came to see a punishing sense of resignation, a man exiled from those he ought to love and who ought to love him. In the poem Iron Man, he imagined his father's strangulated love.
"We cringed at his anger, sudden as steel, rapier-like, but did not feel his wounds that could not utter their need, but bled in silence as martyrs bleed. His rage over trifles, his bitter smile, were the things that we noticed, and yet all the while a frustrated heart was beating there, that wanted to love us, but did not dare."
The change in Williams' story about his father inevitably led to a recalibration of his story about his mother and her legend as the put-upon family saint. Prior to analysis, Williams's narrative of his family was encapsulated in the Glass Menagerie, which essentially presented his mother's version of events. After analysis, Williams's attitude toward his parents became more nuanced. This new version of his story was incorporated into Suddenly Last Summer, which registered the roiling anger and the shock of disenchantment that his analysis had released. On holiday in Europe, after concluding analysis, Williams sank into a deep depression. As he saw it, he had success but no life. He couldn't live without Merleau or with him. His work, which was his way of living, was also becoming his way of dying. He wrote,
"Flying to Europe was certainly not a good move. I became very paranoid soon as I got here, fought with Frank."
During this lonely European sojourn, Williams was trying to bring more clarity both to Sweetbird of Youth and to his bedeviling relationship. Sometime later, he addressed the temperamental and footloose Merleau with the state of their union.
"I'm drunk enough to write you about you and me as I see us and the situation between us. Something you said to me in the first few weeks that we lived together has stuck in my mind all these years. You said, 'I hope you'll never be sick, but if you were, then I could show you, prove to you, how kind I can be to you.' You meant it, I'm sure you did, but you didn't carry it out. Your love never got out of bed. I loved the bed, but it wasn't what I needed. I needed tenderness, sweetness, support, and reassurance all the time, all the way. It was you who threw down the gauntlet in the battle of wills, of egos, that our life together turned into over the years, progressively. QB was quick to see that the situation between us was mutually destructive."
The bed sweetness, the malignant dependency, the fear of running out of time, the hunger to hold on to fame's live wire, the longing for a pure love and the abuse of it. The issue of whether to stay with Merleau or to go, the artist's mortification at a botched work that turns into a big public success. All these intense personal issues in Williams's life found their way into the panorama of Sweetbird of Youth. Analysis had given Williams a sort of detachment from his unfulfillable emotional demands. That newly minted self-awareness lent a tragicomic flavor to the power play between Sweetbird's drugged, exhausted, fading star, Princess Cosmonopolis, and Chance Wayne. Wayne is her hapless, desperate, blackmailing gigolo, and a would-be star who returns to his hometown in a doomed attempt to recover the love of his youth. Once, in 1955, while playing the truth game with Anna Magnani, Williams had shocked her by calling her a monster. He wrote,
"I told her that all good artists were monsters. In the sense of departing extravagantly from the norm, they are always monsters if they have greatness." She was sorrowful over the term, and it lingered in her memory a long time. For almost a year later, she was driving me home from a late party, and she lapsed into a long silence. And then she suddenly turned to me and said, "Tennessee, you are also a monster."
By 1958, Williams had come to agree with her. The term monster was one that he regularly applied to himself. He wrote to Kazan as they were reworking Sweetbird of Youth.
"I am a monster, but I don't hurt anybody by plan or intention. I'm simply very self-centered without confidence in the center, chance without looks, shall we say, and middle-aged, and hate it."
After a grueling decade of celebrity and literary striving, Williams had become all too aware of the shrunken circumference of his life, which brought with it the hardening of his carapace. Williams had become a stranger to himself. He could live successfully in his art, but not in his life. By cultivating his literary persona, he had starved his private one. In May 1958, when Kazan first read and responded to the script of Sweetbird of Youth, he sensed in the play's intensity and in its eloquence that something had shifted in Williams.
"I think this is the most truly, autobiographical play Williams ever wrote. And not in the way Menagerie was autobiographic, not a memory softened and romanticized by time of his youth. But Tennessee tried to describe his state of soul and state of being today and now. It is the frankest play he's written, dealing as it does with his own corruption and his wish to return to the purity he once had. I believe it is Tennessee himself in disguise, right down to the thinning hair.
In the play, Chance has come back to his hometown to try to reclaim Heavenly, the love of his youth. But her father, Boss Finley, had driven him away after their affair. Chance, who doesn't know that he infected Heavenly with a sexually transmitted disease, is unprepared for the extent of Boss Finley's rage. Twice faced with the threat of castration or murder, he refuses to leave town. Chance's stuckness, his reluctance to take action to save his own life, constitutes the suspense of Williams's story. Kazan was right to see a self-portrait in the character of Chance, but in the manipulative cohabitation of Chance and the princess, Williams was also exploring the dynamics of his symbiotic connection to Merlot. The princess, in her hysterical collapse, sees Chance at first as an agent of salvation.
Chance, you've gotta help me stop being the monster that I was this morning. And you can do it. Can help me.
But when she learns that her latest movie is a hit, Chance's needs are immediately erased from her mind. In its ruthlessness, the princess's volte-face demonstrates the centrifugal force of fame, the destiny of me, never of we. Chance is no longer necessary to her. Aglow with a sense of her own importance, the princess pushes him away with lacerating cruelty.
You've just been using me. Using me. A beach boy I picked up for pleasure. Distraction from panic.
The exhausted and demanding diva, fearing the demise of her talent, and the beach boy hustler trying to make meaning of his louche, wasted life, caught at least part of the struggle that bedeviled Williams' relationship with Merlot. The princess and Chance need things in each other. They just don't need each other. At the finale, the princess is raring to return to Hollywood and to her new celebrity. They sit together on the hotel bed in what the stage directions call the huddling together of the lost, but not with sentiment, which is false, but whatever is truthful in the moments when people share doom, face firing squads together. The princess asks Chance to come with her. Will he stay or will he go? Chance is resigned to staying in his hometown, the home of my heart, and to facing his destruction. Chance's decision, like Williams's, is to destroy himself for meaning. As Boss Finley's henchmen lurk on the periphery of the stage, Chance comes downstage at the finale and addresses the audience in the play's sensational last lines. I don't ask for your pity, but just for your understanding. Not even that. No. Just for your recognition of me in you and the enemy time in us all. In these lines, too poetic and too eloquent for Chance, the character morphs into the playwright.
Damian Lewis was reading the last instalment from Tennessee Williams' Mad Pilgrimage of the Flesh by John Lahr. Trevor White was the voice of Tennessee Williams and Ilya Kazan, and Elaine Claxton was the princess. The abridger was Richard Hamilton, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. In a couple of minutes, sex sirens and Swedish feminism. It's all in Woman's Hour after the news. But first, a quick word from a woman with a lot on her plate, including a new series starting this Monday morning.
Hello, my name is Kerry Godleyman. I'm a mother, a comedian, a woman, a human, an earthling, a fan of light country music, a wife, a consumer, a three-dimensional carbon-based life form, and a fervent list maker. Join me for the new series of Kerry's List on BBC Radio 4 this Monday morning at 11:30.